Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In podcast number 41. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm looking at a couple of kind of B science fiction movies from the 1990s. First off, it's going to be 1995's Screamers, starring Peter Weller. And then I'm going to move on to 1996 and have a look at a David Tui movie, The Arrival, which stars Charlie Sheen. But in spite of that, it's a pretty enjoyable movie. It's got a lot to recommend it, and I don't mind it at all. These are not the big movies, these are not the best movies, but they're interesting. So sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we'll start the show. The Martian Drive-In podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Hi, how's everybody doing here? We're doing pretty fine. The weather's still wintry, but I've got myself a cup of cinnamon tea to keep me warm, and I'm using the brand new Blue Yeti microphone that the Patreon campaign supplied to the podcast, and it's lovely. I talked about it in the last Paleo Cinema podcast, but I really do enjoy it. It's a beautiful looking piece of equipment. It's big and chunky. You could kill a person with it. It's that heavy, and it's the sound quality, I'm told, and our friend Morris told me this, sounds good as well. So he's a sound expert to a greater extent than I am anyway. And he likes the sound that's coming out of the microphone, even though it is my voice. So good for us. And that's about all of the microphone podcaster porn you're going to get for this podcast. So let's get on with the movie-related stuff. And I'll just go through the stuff that I've been watching lately, which is of a genre bent. Let's see. And I'm just bringing up the Letterboxd to see that. I did watch one of the DC animated things, and I am prone to watching those. Assault on Arkham, a brand new one, a Batman one. Batman Assault on Arkham, pretty damn good. It's based more around the Arkham Asylum game series than it is on anything from the comics, and it is solid. I'm not going to go into spoilers apart from the fact that, so to say basically that a bunch of people have sold Arkham Asylum to get some data and some stuff out of there, and also Batman turns up, though. It's very much Batman's a secondary character. The Suicide Squad is the main kind of antagonists in the film, and it's worth watching. The animation's solid. The voice work, as with all of the DC animated stuff that's coming out at the moment, is very solid. And it's worth checking out if you're interested in that sort of thing. I did watch a very minor sequel to a classic science fiction film. I'll talk more about very minor sequels to classic science fiction films or even other science fiction films in a moment. But it's Return of the Fly from 1959. It has Vincent Price in it again. Brett Halsey's in it. It's really weird because you have a successful movie like The Fly, 1959 Fly. I'm not talking Cronenberg here. And so they decide to make a sequel. And what do? They decide to take it from the first movie, which was in colour. They decide the sequel is going to be in black and white. So they've really kind of diminished the movie in that sense, because these kind of science fiction and genre works work best in colour, I think, beyond a certain point. I mean, you've got your Universal Horror things, which were all great in black and white. But once colour became really popular, particularly science fiction and horror genre works, I think work a lot better, unless they're kind of the creepy kind, in colour. And I explained that really badly. So I saw that. Yeah, it's kind of slid off my brain like my brain was Teflon coated. So not really going to recommend that one. I did see a Frank Henenlotter movie, which is really interesting. Low budget, very grungy, very transgressive, called Bad Biology. I'm not even going to tell you anything about that, except to say that if you're into kind of
horror stuff and you like Frank Henning a lot of stuff, he did Basket Case, of course, amongst other things, give it a shot. It's a little bit of fun, and it does have nudity in it, so it does have that as one of the virtues, male and female nudity. So go for that. Let's see what else I has watched. The only other genre thing I'm really going to mention that's worth mentioning is I saw Spectre, the TV pilot that Gene Roddenberry did in the early 1970s for a kind of horror, hammerish TV series starring Robert Culp and Gig Young. And it also has John Hurt in it, amongst other people, before John Hurt became the person we know now as John Hurt. And, yeah, I watch it every few years, and I really like it. It's a missed opportunity. I think it would have made a really nice horror TV series. Culp is very good at it. Gig Young, you can tell he's suffering from alcoholism. And in fact, it's actually addressed in the script to the movie. And, yeah, check it out if you can find a good copy. There are so many different copies of this out there, and a lot of them are taped off television, and the quality isn't very good. But if you can find a good quality copy of that, it's definitely worth your time to check out. That's about it for what I've been watching. What did I do on the radio? On the radio, we had a gap for a week. But then, because the bloody football occasionally gets shown on a Thursday night for some reason in Darwin, and then we had to address the elephant in the room when it comes to movie talk of late, and that was the death of Robin Williams. And Liz Travaskis and I did a little bit of a piece on our favourite Robin Williams films. Some of them were genre films, some of them weren't. I name-checked Bicentennial Man because I think Williams is kind of good in it, even though the movie's all over the place, and it looks like something that would have worked better as a mini-series rather than a movie because it's trying to tell an extremely big story in a movie format. But we did justice to it. I've got to address this, and really, it is something that comes up, and this time it's affected me more than it normally does. And that is the kind of meme industry that comes up when somebody of the stature of Robin Williams dies. Of course, you've got the added trigger of the fact that he committed suicide. But there was and because I follow social media as comprehensively as I do, and because I'm always on Facebook and Twitter and other things, I found it very, very oppressive to keep getting more and more little tidbits of information about it and more people mentioning that Robin Williams had died and all that kind of stuff. And it really did get to the stage where I found it a bummer, to use a term from the 1970s. And that kind of led me to my new practice when somebody of that stature dies on social media. And of course, you've got to put a wall around what you do with social media, otherwise it'll suck up all your life if you let it. It's just that kind of a thing. But the policy I'm putting in place is this: on social media, I'm going to mention it once, I'm going to have a sentence or a paragraph perhaps on what I think of the person as an actor. I'm going to keep it strictly to that as well. And then maybe post an embedded YouTube clip. And then I'm going to let it go. Other people can have a chat on the Facebook page, the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook, or on my personal Facebook page. I don't mind which. But I'm really not going to engage much beyond that, because we're in a new age of information now. And I really think that we've got to kind of teach ourselves how to manage that when it comes to something which obviously has had a profound effect on a number of people. A lot of people grew up with Robin Williams movies. A lot of people do suffer from depression, as Robin Williams did, and things like that. But I'm putting a wall around it for myself. It's just a personal policy. You can do what you like with it. But I'm really limiting my exposure to that, if you know what I mean. And I mean, please, if you want to send some feedback and open up a discussion about how people should, in a polite and reasonable society, and in a way that doesn't show you to be an asshole, should people engage with the death of somebody this famous in social media? I mean, what are your ideas on it? What do you think? It hasn't really fucked me up as much as this one did. Previously, not because, other people have died who have been of a similar stature, but really it's messy and it's oppressive at times for me anyway. That's why I didn't engage much when Laura Bacall died a day later. Even though I love Bacall as an actor, I think she's a fine actor. I think that her courage when her husband Humphrey Bogart was dying was inspirational, and she did a whole bunch of work, including working, I mean, she's the only person in history who's worked with somebody like John Huston and then also worked with Lars von Trier. I mean, she's had an incredibly long career, including Long Range, but I didn't engage much with that on social media because of that hangover from the Robin Williams thing. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back from playing the trailer to the first movie, I'm going to talk about the 1995 Canadian science fiction movie Screamers, starring Peter Weller, Roy Dupuis, and Jennifer Rubin, loosely based on a short story, Second Variety, by Philip K. Dick. Indeed, as a lot of the science fiction movies from the 1990s were, it's based on a bit of Dick.
Overlooked and long forgotten by those who settled it. For Commander Joseph A. Hendrickson, it is worse than hell. It is home.
What are they?
There is a new terror in their midst.
We call it a screamer. It was developed for us by Alliance on Earth to neutralize the war on the ground here.
How do you know it's dead?
They yanked this brain out.
Pretty smart.
Maybe too smart.
This one seems to have modified itself.
It was designed to protect them from their enemies. Until it turned its sights on them.
Are they alive?
No one knows. They make themselves now.
I heard the screaming, then it got very quiet. Nothing except the smell of death.
Chuck, we got a new kind of screamer.
It was like a person.
What are they supposed to look like?
Oh, you mean who are they supposed to look like?
They're smarter now. That's how they get into our bunkers.
Once it gets inside, that's when the killing starts.
Now, the only way to tell man...
He's one of them.
...from machine... No! ...is by the sound of their scream.
Things ain't what they used to be.
Okay, here is the précis for the film from IMDb. On a distant mining planet ravaged by decades of war, scientists have created the perfect weapon, a blade-wielding, self-replicating race of killing devices known as Screamers, designed for one purpose only, to hunt down and destroy all enemy life forms. But man's greatest weapon has continued to evolve without any human guidance, and now it has devised a new mission to obliterate all life. Colonel Hendrickson, Peter Weller, is in command of a handful of Alliance soldiers still alive on Sirius 6B, betrayed by his own political leaders and disgusted by the atrocities of this never-ending war, Hendrickson decides he must negotiate a separate peace with the new economic bloc's decimated forces. But to do so, he will have to cross a treacherous landscape where the deadliest threat comes from the very weapons he helped create. And that's pretty much it. It's a solid premise. It drifts a little bit from the original Second Variety Philip K. Dick story, in that that was a Cold War analogy. It was an extension of the Cold War, so it was the Soviets versus the Allies kind of thing projected into the future. But this one's on a different planet, so they can kind of ditch a whole bunch of the now obsolete political bipolarism that existed in the, I think it was the 50s when Dick wrote the story. Now, normally with these kinds of films, you'll feel you do it in a desert landscape and there'd be dust and everything's in sepia tone and all that kind of thing. But this one, because it's a Canadian film, was filmed in and around Montreal, which means that it's bloody cold and there's a lot of snow around. And that gives it a slightly different feel than a lot of these kinds of movies, where most people would find a desert. What they've found is a kind of deserted industrial landscape in a cold climate. And that kind of works because there have been nuclear weapons let off on the planet, and that, of course, leads to a nuclear winter situation. So, yeah, it makes sense there. You can actually use that to work in favour of the story. Apart from Peter Weller, the cast isn't really terribly strong. You got Roy Dupuis playing Becker, one of the survivors, who's a hard-ass guy with a knife, and he's got tears tattooed on his cheeks underneath his eyes, and basically is a major asshole. You've got a whole bunch of other people, a newbie soldier, Jefferson, played by Andrew Lauer, who's just out of basic training and is pretty clueless and has to accompany Colonel Hendrickson across this dangerous landscape to get to the new economic bloc soldiers that they're going to make peace with. And you've got Jennifer Rubin as Hansen, a black market merchant who's trapped in the new economic bloc city and is kind of running things over there for the handful of survivors that are there. Now, having said that, there are parallels with Blade Runner in this movie, so you've really got to acknowledge them and move on to a certain extent. But it works well. There's still room for these kind of B science fiction movies, I think. We're so overwhelmed in the media with the blockbusters, the great big new thing that's coming out, that we forget there's an entertainment value in these kind of lower budget but honest science fiction movies. And to be honest with you, given the limitations, I think it only had something like, what was the budget on it? He said, looking it up and trying to be suave and pretend that he knew, $20 million. And the $20 million budget, it did pretty well. There's a lot of good practical effects work. There's, of course, some a little bit of CGI, mostly in the landscapes and the what used to be done with hanging mats and map paintings and things is now done with computer-generated stuff. But it works well to serve the story by the practical effects of the Screamers, which are also known as autonomous mobile swords, which gives you a bit of an idea about how they function. They're more like autonomous mobile chainsaws in a lot of cases. But they do have a real creepiness about them. They're under the ground, and all you see is a kind of moving tuft of dust travelling towards you, screaming at you, and then it leaps out of the ground and cuts you to pieces. And they do demonstrate that very effectively very early in the film when one of the new economic bloc soldiers comes with an offering of peace. And after crossing the landscape, comes up against the Screamers that are surrounding the base and defending the base, and gets cut to pieces by them. So you do get a sense really soon that these things are tough. They're programmed very well, and there just seem to be more and more of them around, which is at the start of concern to the soldiers on Hendrickson's side of the equation. And the fact that they sometimes don't obey the rules. Now, one of the ways that the Screamers find people is by tracing their heartbeat. And the Alliance soldiers wear something on their wrist which kind of mutes or distorts their heartbeat, or the sound of their heartbeat. Like that. See, I can do that on the desk now with a new microphone. And that then makes them invisible to the Screamers, so they think. But as they travel across the landscape and they find that things aren't quite what they thought they'd be. They meet up with a young child who walks around carrying a teddy bear, and they don't know how the kid survived 4 years of war, but the kid somehow has. Of course, the kid turns out to be a screamer themselves, and that anybody who's familiar with genre films at all knows that's going to be the case. But that then plays into a larger scene later on, so that kind of isn't the... That's only the first of the two shoes dropping, in a sense. There is a play later on where a whole army of those little kids emerges from a base and starts attacking the people, and that kind of works really well. The original thing, yeah, it's a little bit naff, but what we don't know is it's the setup for that larger thing with all of the other little kids with the teddy bears coming out of the base. So, yeah, I kind of like it for a number of reasons. First off, I think that Peter Weller is an actor who can be a bit hit and miss in movies. I think there are times when he's phoned it in, as indeed a lot of jobbing actors have. I think that his Buckaroo Banzai could have been a little stronger at times. I don't know whether I mentioned that when I did Buckaroo Banzai on the podcast, but I think the charisma should have been up and the cool maybe a little bit down. but he was shooting for cool rather than charismatic, and I think the Buckaroo Banzai needed a bit more charisma than Peter Weller brought to the role at the time. But leaving that aside, in this one he's good. They've got some really nice little details in the film as well. The fact that there are these red cigarettes you've got to smoke to keep the radiation out of your lungs. It's a kind of anti-cancer cigarette in a sense. And they've only got a certain number of them, and they've got to go through some landscapes that are pretty radioactive. And yet they walk around smoking these red cigarettes, which are kind of anti-cigarettes, you might think, in that they basically prevent cancer, which is kind of cool. And I hope it never happens, because cigarette companies would have a field day with it, first selling us cigarettes and then selling us red cigarettes to cure it with. Their cash flow would increase many times, and the arseholes would win then. But having said that, there's that. A lot of the computer technology looks dated now, which is a bit unfortunate. That's the same thing you get with any science fiction movie, really, is that after about 10 years or so, any of the slightly futuristic computer gear you've got is pretty naff. But having said that, there are movies where the technology is dated, but it still looks pretty cool, like Forbidden Planet, where they didn't have, I mean, all they had was a flat video screen, which is pretty much something that you can feel fairly safe is going to stay for at least a while, until Google Glasses really hit their stride. And but yeah, I always find it interesting, and it doesn't take me out of the film. It kind of enhances the film for me a little bit when I see slightly archaic technology, in a sense, because you can then analyse what they were trying to do, and you know, try to remember back what was computer technology like for me in 1995. I think it was dial-up modems and enormous monitors and things like that. And the graphic user interface was kind of clunky looking, because the computer monitors didn't have the resolution that computer monitors now have. But having said that, there are some nice scenes where soldiers are running through a kind of industrial landscape, including some underground tunnels that look very, very cool. And obviously they found a location where some industrial complex was about to be torn down, and they've used the tunnels really well. They've kind of stapled up lighting along the tunnels and used them effectively as part of the plan. And they've also used a whole bunch of what looks like they've gone into some fairly modern architecture at night time, messed it up a bit, and shown it to be part of the city that used to be there. And they do there's a video shown of how cool the city was before it was pretty much destroyed during the war, and how it was a kind of holiday destination for a lot of people. Of course, people traveling interstellar for holiday destinations is kind of cool in itself, but a little bit unrealistic, of course. But it does have an honesty about it that a lot of genre films don't have, in that they're telling a solid story. They're trying to make the soldiers realistic in there. They're trying to make the technology as realistic as they can. And Peter Weller's kind of minimalist acting at best, except when he does things like the latest Star Trek movie where he starts screaming and going over the top. But Peter Weller's level of acting that he usually has kind of works well as a soldier. And he does bring his A game to the movie in a lot of ways, which I kind of like as well. But given that it's winter too, I found the movie a little bit strange for me, because I was feeling a bit chilly that day when I was watching it. And if you see a movie set in a cold climate when you're feeling a little bit chilly, it just makes it a little bit more realistic in a sense, but also a little bit more unpleasant, because I do like to be warm. I'm a warm weather person stuck in a temperate environment, so what can you do about that? The ending of the film is quite interesting too. They've got a scene where one character is fighting against a robot duplicate of themselves, and it could have been something that played to the cliches that we've got from things like the Terminator movies, but it really doesn't. It's filmed in a long, narrow area where there's a spaceship ready to launch out of the long, narrow area, and within the limitations of the budget, they do a pretty good job of showing the fight as it should be, with, you know, two identical people. One of them is wearing a hat so that the stunt player can be seen in the scene without spoiling the illusion of them both being the same person. But it does work pretty well, and there's a bit with some jets that are going to launch the rocket into space that does kind of have a nice coolness to it, even if these by a modern standards, the computer graphics are a bit ropey. You like the fact that they tried it. You kind of, that's increasingly how I'm looking at a lot of these special effects, where before our computer graphics were what they are now, they at least made the attempt to use them to portray something that they couldn't portray any other way. And somebody being blasted by retro rockets isn't something you can really do as an in-camera effect very effectively. This, however, it kind of works well, and I liked it. I mean, I enjoyed that kind of thing. It was the sort of thing that at the time, watching, and you've got to remember that when this first came out in 1995, a lot of the people were still watching this stuff on VHS, so your screen definition wasn't fantastic. So slightly ropey CGI, the screen was a little bit more forgiving of it than it is on a DVD or a Blu-ray copy of this film. And, it's a good, honest little B picture, and a lot of fun for that, too. And that's the other thing you can do with these kind of movies, too. With a B picture, you're not staking an immense fortune. I mean, you know, $20 million is a lot of money, but in the scheme of things, it's not an immense amount. Whereas if you're paying, at the time, it would have been about $100 million to $150 million at the most for an A picture, tentpole kind of movie. With a B-movie, you can kind of try to convey ideas and try to convey stuff that you really weren't willing to take the risk to convey in a much larger movie. There are a few different films that I remember that really did have some good, honest, dead, solid space opera science fiction concepts. But you knew that it wouldn't work in a larger film because some people would be sitting in the audience going, "What just happened? What was this about? What's this mean?" And that kind of thing. You can assume that you're not going to get as big an audience as you will with a tentpole film, but you're still going to get an audience that's science fiction literate to an extent, and they're going to go along with you with things like robots that appear to be human. Now, there is one proviso there. There is a scene where one of the characters makes love to a robot, and this is the problem I've had with this and movies like Westworld. For a start, yeah, you may get the skin texture right and all that kind of thing. You'll get all of that kind of stuff right, and the eyes close up. You may, well, forgive even that. But the thing is about having sex with somebody, there's a lot more to it than just the way things look and the way things feel. There's smell. There's all sorts of other very subtle things that are very hard to do unless you've got an incredibly complex chemistry set embedded somewhere in this sexually attractive body to fake a lot of the almost subconscious and subliminal effects of sexual arousal. And it's just not going to work. It's going to feel wrong in a lot of ways if you don't have these subtle things in there. It's going to feel like what it essentially is, which is fucking a dummy. But I always have that as a kind of barrier to me enjoying things. A bit where Richard Benjamin has sex with a robot in Westworld. You think, nah, icky. It's just not going to work for me. Part of it's the psychological effects as well. I mean, even if you're just having casual sex with somebody, you're learning about them as a person at a deeper level than you would in a casual or in a friend zone kind of approach there. And you're not going to get that kind of nuance of behavior from a robot. So sex with robots in movies, forget it. Don't like it. It always spoils the suspension of disbelief for me. And maybe that's just me. I don't like to have sex with things that come out of factories. It's just me. So leave it at that. Fleshlights, robots, it's all the same to me. So leaving it at that, a fun film, a bit of Canadian 1990s sense of wonder, science fiction, with robots and decapitations and all sorts of other things that we want to see in a film. There was a sequel made to it in 2009 as well. I tried to watch it. I watched the first 20 minutes of it. It was so boring that I gave up on it. If you want to have a look at it, it's called Screamers: The Hunting. And, it really is a diminished product, and I did give it a go to try to talk about it, but nah. Just nah. Anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and when we get back, we're going to talk about a David Tuohy movie. It came from the same guy who did the Riddick films, which I kind of like. And it's The Arrival from 1996, starring Charlie Sheen, Lindsay Krause, Richard Schiff, Ron Silver, and Terry Polo.
Station 5.
Is my voice even vaguely familiar to you, Zane? I really don't want a repeat of last week.
Look, if I say I'm going to be there, I will be there. End of story. There is nothing more important to me right now than a...
Searching for ETs in this political environment is a tough sell.
I come to you with the possibility of extrasolar life. I can't afford it.
They're acting like it never happened. It's like we never gave him any tape.
The first signal is definitely sky-based, but this one is Earth-based. Something's going on here, Char. What is it that they're trying to hide?
It's a troubled young man.
Why are you telling them lies about me? I want my tape back. I want it back.
They've branded his theory paranoid.
There are some DOD guys here going through our stuff.
I don't know who these guys are, but I do know that they're lying to you.
And the only ones who believe what's coming...
If they're not here now, they will be soon.
Posing.
...are the ones who've already arrived.
Right now, as much as you think you know, you don't know the half of it.
Why did they leave?
They didn't.
How do you know?
Because we aren't dead yet.
Move! Stop watching the skies.
I know why they're here.
Start watching Look Back. Charlie Sheen, Ron Silver, The Arrival.
Like I said, see,
you didn't know the half of it.
Okay, The Arrival is a 1996 science fiction film written and directed by David Tuohy, the guy who gave us all three Riddick films, and we'll forget the second one because it was rubbish. But, yeah, it's... Basically, Charlie Sheen plays a radio astronomer who finds an extraterrestrial radio signal from a star 14 light years from Earth. He reports it to his supervisor, Phil Gordian, played by Ron Silver at JPL. But Phil dismisses the claim, as you heard in the clip. Zane finds out that he's been blacklisted and prevented from working with other telescopes. He takes a job as a television satellite installer and starts tracing the signal himself, and finds out that there is an extraterrestrial invasion underway, and one of the things they're doing is terraforming the planet to their needs, which means they're making the atmosphere of the Earth hotter and basically creating a place that's more suited to their life than for ours. And the science in this movie, for the most part, are the basic science, and it is pretty good. The aliens are from an F-class star, which is a hotter and more actinic star than ours. The alien design is pretty good. They're lean. They've got these kind of flaps over their skulls to help them cool their brains. And they radiate heat pretty extensively. And you can see heat when they get cut, you can see heat ripples coming out of it because their bodies are significantly hotter than a human one. And that's kind of cool. You got to jump over the problem of Charlie Sheen being the protagonist in this movie too, to a certain extent. Charlie Sheen does an okay job of it, but there are probably other actors who might have done it better. But again, it's a fairly low budget film, and again, I'm going to look up how much it cost to make because I've totally forgotten it. Budget was $25 million, so it wasn't too much more than Screamers. But in spite of that, and again in spite of some now dubious special effects, it does work kind of well. The aliens are CGI, but for the most part, there are some practical effect aliens in it as well. But they're kind of cool. Their knees bend the other way from ours, and that means they walk really oddly. And it's kind of cool because they gave them that to make them... Oh, well, for a couple of reasons. One is to make them look severely non-human, but also because there are a couple of surprise bits where their knees bend in the opposite direction. And they've got a technology that lets them have a kind of organic overlay so they can appear to be human as well. So they've mastered the art of disguising themselves to be human beings. And this has a payoff later in the film, because as the movie progresses, Zane finds out really cleverly where the signal's coming from. The way he does this is he gets a job as a television satellite installer, and he decides that he can't get a big telescope to find this signal. So what he does is he sets up an array, and that's a whole bunch of smaller dishes, to pick up the signal. And the way he does this is he decides to set up an array by getting all the satellite dishes in his neighbourhood networked together, because he's a satellite installer, he can go and do that sort of thing. So he basically hacks the satellite dishes for the whole neighbourhood to make a much larger array, which is dead solid science. So a lot of the radio astronomy now is being done with arrays rather than with one big dish. And the fact that a lot of houses at the time had satellite dishes kind of worked really in favour of doing this, and it is a kind of nice little conceit. So Zane finds out that the signal is being bounced coming down from space, but it's also an upload coming through from a place in Mexico, and he decides to travel down to Mexico, where he meets the character played by Lindsay Krause. She's investigating global warming from an environmental point of view. She's a climatologist. Her character's name's Alana Green, and she's down there to try to investigate the fact that there's a heat spot, a source of severe temperature increases around this Mexican town. Lindsay Krause, interesting actor in her own right. Her father, Russell Krause, wrote the original book for Sound of Music, amongst other things. He was a writer on Broadway, and at one stage Lindsay Krause was married to David Mamet as well. But she's in there playing, she's a slightly older person, a woman than Zane, and she makes an approach to him, which is kind of interesting and written quite subtly and quite well. But he's got a girlfriend, Shah, played by Terry Polo, back in America, so he kind of knocks her back. Nonetheless, it's kind of done in an interesting way, the kind of flirtatious relationship between the two when they meet in Mexico. And, of course, they're both strangers in a strange land. The Day of the Dead's approaching, so there are lots of skeleton toys around the place. And there's one lot of skeleton toys which, and this is again is a clever little bit of plotting, look like the aliens to a certain extent. And there's a man selling these puppet skeleton alien things around town who turns out to be an undercover alien himself. But a lot of it was filmed on location in Mexico in some interesting place. I think it was in Oaxaca. So you've got some nice landscapes there, the mountains, the jungles, the urban landscapes of Mexico. There's a really interesting bit in the dodgy hotel that Zane gets, where some of the infrastructure maybe isn't as good as it should be, and that builds up an interesting moment or two in there to kind of break up the tension. But eventually Zane does get to the base for the aliens, which is a disused power station, and beneath the disused power station is an alien base, and that's where things get really interesting there and really creative, because Tui and his team really did think it through. They've got technology that doesn't look anything like human technology. Yes, they got some touchscreen computers, which again is an innovation from 1996. You've got the machinery that creates the global warming gases is really cool too, and basically is a source of a whole bunch of tension and a whole bunch of action between Zane and the aliens as he invades the alien base. And there's another bit where he finds the machine that puts the organic overlay over the aliens. And that, again, has an interesting payoff in the film. It's a movie with a whole bunch of small imaginative bits in it that really do work well to tell this story. And it makes those connections. And, in fact, the very first scene of the film is quite imaginative as well, where Lindsay Krause's character, Alana Green, is investigating some poppies in a field. And she's there with a couple of other scientists, and they pull back from this poppy field that they found and discover that, well, I'm not going to spoil that bit. It's a nice little touch there. And it works really well to set the movie up as one where freaky things are happening and people are investigating them. Now, as far as Charlie Sheen being the protagonist, yeah, he's a man who's obviously got his problems. He's a man who's fried his brain to more or less of an extent. But his craziness, his innate troubled nature, let's say, works in favour of the character who becomes obsessed about this signal and goes to extraordinary lengths to investigate it and eventually to a certain extent prevail against an alien invasion. One crazy guy and his girlfriend's help who kind of slows down at least the alien invasion in a weird way. And there's some good alien technology in here. There's a ball which basically creates a singularity and sucks everything into itself to a certain extent. And that's used to great effect, including some really unusual point of view shots from the point of view of this black hole ball, which kind of makes for, again, it's an imagination in use, thinking it through and trying to find a different visual way of telling the story. Yes, you can see the spinning ball from the outside and everything getting sucked into it and the wind blowing everything around as it gets sucked in. But having that point of view shot from the ball really does kind of add to the eeriness of it. Leon Rippey's in there as one of the aliens' agents, and Leon Rippey has spent a whole career playing pretty much rednecks, a creepy-looking bugger with funny teeth and a very effective, menacing persona, and he's in there really well. Ron Silver playing Gordian, one of the main villains of the piece, is effective as he usually is. Apparently Ron Silver, who died a few years ago, was also very right-wing, so that adds to his villainy as far as I'm concerned. It's always good to have characters playing villains who are right-wing idiots, and I'll use that advisedly, because it means that I'm already pre-programmed to dislike them. So when they play villains in movies, it just makes that leap of faith that, yes, this is the bad guy, so much smoother, knowing that the actor was somebody whose belief systems were contrary to my own, let's put it that way. And just like Screamers, this movie did have a sequel, known imaginatively as Arrival 2, also The Second Arrival from 1998. This was done as a Canadian movie, like the original Screamers was. And I did watch this one all the way through yesterday, and I kind of regret it because it isn't very good. It was done on something like a third of the budget of The Arrival and stars nobody at all, you know, apart from Michael Sarrazin playing a professor. Professor. In it, and it's interesting to see Michael Sarrazin in a movie again. The only thing I can say that's good about Arrival 2 is there is some full frontal female nudity in there for no really good reason, apart from the fact that it was available to them, I suppose. But I don't, even it being the sort of person I am, it's really not enough to get you through the movie. It a lot of it is, and one of the things I noticed about this that annoyed the fuck out of me is that there are way too many close-ups in it. There's just there are scenes where you think, yeah, pull the camera back just a little bit, maybe, you know, like 10 feet or so, and this bit's going to play out better. Give a little bit of background to it. But not the person who made it, whose name is Kevin Tenney, really did hug the faces of the actors in this film to a large extent, when he really, there was no real need to do so for what the scene was showing. You know, show them out in a bit of a long shot for the change. Vary the length of the shots up in that sense. Not the duration of the shots, but just the how close they are to it. Because I really did get sick of looking at people's heads during the viewing of that film. But it has a lot of the same things in there. There's a little bit of the aliens, though. They didn't have the CGI budget of The Arrival, and it was a pure cashing in exercise and a bit of a waste of time, really. But the first one I kind of like. I like the fact that David Tui does like his science. He does like credibility in his science. And that's shown in a number of the films he's made. He's made a number of really cool and interesting science fiction movies. I do like the three Riddick films. I think the Vin Diesel helps carry them off, but I like the hard-ass asshole versus monsters kind of approach that the first and the third movie at least took. And the fact that they do create a very lived-in future universe, which is a hard thing to do. It's something you've really got to think through. It's something you talk it over with the set designers and the prop designers and the actors and everybody like that. Everything's just got to come into place just right to have a properly looking lived-in universe. And the first Pitch Black had that. It was filmed here in Australia. And just by the fact that Keith David's character was a Muslim, for instance, just having that kind of cultural diversity there in the future universe posited by Tui when he was making the Riddick movies kind of works really well. And you can see him working up to that in this film. There's little bits and pieces. The fact that he did take the production to Mexico to do it, to bring in that other culture as well, and to in a sense alienate Zane Zeminski even more from his comfort zone by taking him to a foreign country and having interactions with the police and really not knowing who his friends were and who weren't his friends. It worked really well, and I think that makes Tui a director who has a lot more clout with me than a lot of other people who have made more successful science fiction films, because he does sweat the small stuff when he makes these things, and that gives him a lot of credibility with me. I hate future science fiction movies where they really don't do the hard work, and the hard work is in the fine detail, where the attitudes of the people are exactly the same as people's attitudes now, for instance, that there's no alteration to culture in a future universe. That really does piss me off in science fiction movies to a big extent. But having said that, I do like The Arrival. It's a bit of fun. There's a big finish on an enormous satellite dish in the desert, which is kind of works really well. And I think that they do a combination of computer and practical effects that work really well to convey what happens there. So I'm not going to talk too much else about it. The Arrival, I think, is a better film than Screamers, but I'm not quite sure why. I think it is that kind of attention to detail and the fact that it was a movie about being warm, and I watched these movies in the wintertime. It could be as simple and shallow as that. But having said that, I'm going to take a break now, and then I'm going to finish up. I do believe we've got a little bit of feedback here, and we'll do the feedback. I'll plug the Patreon campaign, because I plug the Patreon campaign. We do have a couple of extra contributors to that, which is very nice, and thank you very much to Matt-O-Matic for your contribution in particular. But I'll take another break now. I'm going to get back. We'll do the Patreon thing, and we'll do the credits, where I have to give a movie-style credit to everybody who supports the Patreon campaign, as I have agreed to do. Okay, we've got some feedback here from Tim Levy over in New Jersey, I think you are, Tim. He says, got to say, I didn't like Witch Hunt nearly as much as Cast a Deadly Spell, which is surprising. The problem is that the parallels to McCarthyism are obvious and heavy-handed, and pretty much blames it on Boghossian Senator McCarthy analogue, without mentioning or really dealing with any of the deeper political issues at all. Yeah, the movie's metaphorical, but it's all too easy to blame McCarthy for the blacklists and the destruction of lives, and figure it ended when his political ambitions did, and to completely ignore attempts by major players to roll back the social changes, including increased power and equality for women and blacks, caused by fighting fascists during World War II. I don't recollect there being an actual racist tinge to Senator Crockett's targeting of Hippolyta Kropotkin, as there was a lot of particularly southern-based anti-communism. Let's not forget that McCarthyism could have easily been Nixonism, since Nixon got his start after alleged communists like UN founding father Alger Hiss. Also, Dennis Hopper doesn't get the whole hard-boiled PI character at all, which Fred Ward did. Not as good an actor as a rule. Inhabited like a second skin. Which cast Deadly Spell had gone to series, a 40s private eye series in a universe where magic is real, would have been great. I agree with you, Tim. It would have been great. I would have liked to have seen it. I think Fred Ward as a hard-boiled private eye character of any kind really works well. I think he's got the toughness you need for that, and he's also got the wit and the charisma as an actor. I mean, one of the things I forget about hard-boiled private eye characters is you've got to have a charismatic actor. Even if you look at things like James Garner as Jim Rockford, a lot of charisma there. You've got David Jansen as Harry O. You've got way back as far as Bogart, of course, and Dick Powell and people like that. You need to have a strongly charismatic actor as a private eye. And I agree, Dennis Hopper doesn't have that. Yeah, the McCarthyism thing was kind of just a little conceit. I don't think it was as deep as it could have been. They could have played it in a series, of course, as an ongoing thing, had they chosen to do so. But nonetheless, I do like the fact that they attempted these movies and made them, because it really is a groovy kind of a universe to be invited into. But that's pretty much it for the podcast. This time it's going to be slightly shorter than most of them. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another. I'll be back in a week with another Paleo Cinema podcast, which will be a lot of fun. In the meantime, I'm going to do the credits, and I'm adding another credit to the end of it. So, Matomatic, your official movie credit is Rattlesnake Wrangler. So I'll just play the credits now, and I'll see you guys again in 2 weeks. And as usual, thanks to the people who have subscribed via the Patreon campaign and donated just a little bit of money toward the podcast recording costs. And as a part of that, everybody gets a credit in the style of a movie credit. So we have to thank Alyssa, our location scout, Tansy, the Foley artist, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Christopher, the gaffer, Chris, the camera operator, Julia, the casting director, Jan, the dialect coach, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the music director, Armin, the key grip, Tom, the focus puller, also known as the first assistant director, Sarah, the special effects director, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, and Sally, who is the assistant to Mr. Frost. Thank you to everybody who's been involved, and if people do want to get involved, they can go to patreon.com/paleocinema.